This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rock Cash, your host this week on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen by phone calling 716-748-0144. Or if you have a smartphone or a computer, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to Station 2, click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with calling questions for our guests toll-free, USA and Canada, 888-429-5471. It's a pleasure tonight to have Adam Winkler with us. Adam is a constitutional lawyer and a professor. He is a professor at the UCLA School of Law. Adam is also was also a child actor, played in Robert De Niro's son as in the movie New York, New York. Adam has very, very extensive background in constitutional law. He is nationally recognized, and he is a contributor to many publications, radio, and media outlets. Adam, after reading your book, it seems the point that you're making, and I tend to agree with you, is the laws against the Second Amendment are just a mere tool of supremacy.
Well, indeed, laws against the right to bear arms are a very common feature of the American landscape. Sometimes they're used to deny people their liberty. If you want to keep people a second-class group of citizens, then one of the things you do is disarm them. We know that one of the earliest kinds of gun control America had was laws regulating possession of firearms by African Americans, whether they were slave or free. And the framers had laws that banned them from possessing weapons. And the very idea was that if they had weapons, they would be able to rise up against their deprivation of liberty, that guns would be used for self-defense to fight and preserve their liberty. And they didn't want African Americans to have that. And indeed, throughout American history, gun control has often had an element of denial of liberty. But I think that would be a one-sided picture to only emphasize that side of it. I think there is also a long history of efforts to try to regulate, in the genuine interest of public safety, firearms that are dangerous, especially in urban areas.
Well, I agree of certain types of regulations, you know, mental illnesses, things of that nature. But even when you implement those laws of mental illness or anything else, they can pretty much claim anybody to be mentally ill just for the sake of it and say, well, you lost your rights to bear arms. So it could be used to enforce, you know, the tyrannistical movement of taking away firearms from regular civilians.
Well, there's no doubt that whenever the government tries to deny our liberty, and one of the reasons why we have the Constitution is to protect us from the government's efforts to deny us our liberty. But one of the things that we always have to have respected is due process. And with regards to denial of anyone's gun rights, anyone's speech rights, anyone's privacy rights, it's important that we don't lose sight of the very basic foundational constitutional principle that the government must afford due process of law to every person. And so if you want to take away people's firearms because they're mentally ill, it's important that you have safeguards to be sure that the people whose firearms you're taking away from are truly mentally ill and are people who are in that category who can't really be trusted with possession of firearms, and that it's not just government picking out people and denying people's liberty willy-nilly.
Well, we kind of know that veterans are pretty much a target of the Big Brother because, you know, we see it in the media. We see the advertisement of it going out to the people saying, oh, well, government, you know, veterans are, you know, pretty much the outcast now. And it seems that anybody that wants to stand up for their rights is an outcast to the government or to the people of America in the eyes of the media.
Well, that may be the case, but certainly with regards to guns, I'd say many of these debates are in some ways not new, that we've been really battling over the right to bear arms since we were an early nation. Earlier I mentioned those founding era gun control laws, like laws banning African Americans from possessing firearms. But even back then, they also had concerns about public safety. Well, the city of Boston, for instance, barred people from possessing firearms in a loaded firearm in any dwelling, building, or place where people inhabit. So there were a long history of gun control in the nation, and often, surprisingly, veterans have been among those whose right to bear arms has often been respected. And one of the arguments for letting people have firearms in their home was often that people had fought honorably in the wars, and they could thus be trusted with firearms. And, of course, that resonates with the founding era ideas, too, where one of the reasons why we have protections in for the Second Amendment for that well-regulated militia and that right of the people to keep and bear arms is because of a sense that we, the people, would be responsible for our own armed self-defense.
Well, what laws are you for exactly? Are you for the regulations of magazine capacity, or are you for the regulations of just keeping handguns off the streets? Because we know that the criminals still get them no matter what. When I lived in New York, and I believe you lived there also, it was easier for me to go out and pick up a pistol out on the streets on the black market than it was for me to buy one legally, because I had to go through extensive background checks, 6 months of background checks, and then interviews with detectives and everything else just to get a pistol to target practice.
Yeah, well, of course, New York has some of the most restrictive gun control laws in the nation, and yours would not be the first to complain about how long it takes to get permits. And there's no doubt that New York will be one of the real battlefields, I think, over the right to bear arms in the next 10 years or so, especially in the Supreme Court, because if there's any laws that are going to be struck down for making it too difficult to get your hands on a handgun, it might well be those New York laws. So in terms of what laws am I for, what laws am I for against, I mean, one of the things that I really argue in my book is that there is a proper place for gun control, but because it is a constitutional right that we're dealing with, then we have to be careful about the forms of gun control that we use. We have to have gun control that's based on evidence, that's going to further the further public safety. I think now, well, you laugh, and I think that's the real issue. You know, many gun control laws don't do that. I mean, if you look at things like attempts to ban so-called military-style assault weapons, here's an effort that's preoccupied, for instance, the Obama administration and Democrats on Capitol Hill, and it's really been a sideshow. Very, very few people are hurt with these rifles every year. It's less than 300 rifle-based firearms deaths every year. Only a subgroup of even those 300 are so-called assault weapons. So here's a law that's been pursued that really won't bring down any rates of gun violence, so probably not worth having. But I think having a background check system, for instance, where you have gun purchasers have to do a background check, makes it more difficult for many people to get their hands on guns, for criminals to get their hands on guns, but not law-abiding people to get their hands on guns. And, you know, one of the things I want to say is that I never really gave in to the argument myself, personally, that, well, criminals are going to get guns anyway. Well, of course criminals are going to get guns anyway. There's 320 million guns in America. They're going to get their hands on guns. Ones who are really committed to do so are going to get their hands on guns. But we don't say that, you know, we're going to give up laws against murder or against speeding because people will commit murder or people will speed. Of course they will. Just like drunk driving, our goal should be trying to bring down the numbers, making it much more difficult for criminals to get their hands on guns, and then that'll reduce some of the access. Only at the margins, but that's, you know, those are people's lives you're saving, and that should be the goal rather than eliminating it or having some belief that maybe all of a sudden some law is going to keep criminals from getting one of the 320 million guns in America.
Well, bringing down the violences and the criminal activities usually happens when the economy is vibrant and people are working and people have what I want to call a rational amount of freedom when it comes to being able to afford things and things of that nature. Crimes really aren't committed, but it is the impoverished situations that we're in with homeless all over the place. And this seems to be the major problem. And the amount of drugs that is being brought into the nation, it doesn't seem like they're passing laws against those and keeping the drugs out of the country, because evidently it's not working. Maybe they should focus on those laws and not disarming the people.
Well, in my view, actually, I think there's an important lesson that we can take from the failed war on drugs to think about gun regulation. You know, I hear a lot of people who don't like the right to bear arms, who think we need a lot more gun control. Many of them even say what we need to do is get rid of the right to bear arms at all, and we should try to get rid of all civilian ownership of firearms. Like, what's wrong, they say? Let's get rid of all the guns. And it's the same kind of unrealistic goal that drove the temperance movement to prohibit people from drinking alcohol in the Prohibition era. A failed experiment, if there ever was one. And it was the same idea behind the war on drugs, an idea that we could just crack down, make it harder to get drugs, and criminalize drug use, and people won't do it. And we've seen that that was a failed effort, too. And what we've learned is that, you know, you can try to ban guns, but you can't ban small, easy-to-conceal things that people really love and that are really in abundant and, frankly, easy to get your hands on. You can't ban them. That's got to be taken off the table as a goal for public safety regulation in America. And I think that, you know, if we can get over that idea, I think we'd make a real contribution and a real movement forward in the gun debate and really think about whether there are laws short of that that can work or don't work. Get rid of the ones that don't work. Maybe if we need to shore up some of the ones that we have to make them better, we should do that too.
Yeah, I totally concur. My fear is that, you know, they want to take away, well, here in California, they've limited magazines to 10-round magazines. And the thing is, people that have these weapons and they go out and they play with them on the weekends and stuff like that, they're not out to commit any crimes. They're not out to do anything against the public. They're just... it's their recreational time, and they enjoy doing that, as I do myself, because I've owned a few assault weapons, and I'm also former military. But so these laws intentionally restrict your capabilities of being able to defend yourself against, say, for instance, a police state.
Well, I think that's really going to be the important question. I would say that, you know, to the extent the right to bear arms is about shooters going to the range and having fun shooting, then I don't think it's going to get very much protection by the courts, because the Constitution is generally not concerned with that kind of recreational activity, no matter how much fun it is. But I think it really is about that self-defense point. And I think that if the what we've seen so far in the courts is that the courts have generally upheld restrictions on high-capacity magazines, saying that it's not a significant restriction on anyone's right of self-defense. I don't know whether that's the right reasoning in those cases, but the argument that the court offers is that generally it does not take more than 10 rounds to defend yourself. In fact, of what we know of, there's maybe up to 2 million instances a year where someone uses a firearm as self-defense. And the vast majority of those, 90-something percent of those, no shots are fired at all. And incidents where shots are fired, it's rarely more than 2 shots. So there is, I think it will often come down to the question of whether that's a restriction on someone's real right of self-defense, and not so much on whether... unfortunately, what many people really do care about, which is, hey, I just want to go to the range and shoot a bunch of rounds. It's fun.
Well, that is a part of it, of course, but the other part of it is to keep our liberties at hand and keep us ourselves free from tyrannistical movements. This seems to be the case right now, where we're in a much bigger and much bigger and much bigger government, where...
Well, I don't think that a world in which we have 320 million guns in civilian hands is one in which the framers would think we don't have the arms necessary to defend ourselves from that kind of violence. Whatever they were imagining in terms of the number of guns would be in possession of a society, I imagine that one per person would probably be as many as they could have imagined. And while I think we do have to be on guard for laws that would significantly reduce the ability of the people to be armed, to provide that armed protection, I'm not sure whether 10-round magazines are really make that important leap over that edge, given how easy it is to have multiple rounds. Hey, look, this shooter in Santa Barbara, who shows perhaps maybe the foolishness of trying to regulate high-capacity magazines too. You know, he went and he had, what, 40 of these high-capacity magazines fully loaded and ready to go? And you're a shooter, and, you know, it only takes a second to replace those. So I don't think that itself would be a very significant restriction. But the reason why it wouldn't be also perhaps shows why, as a gun control law, it's not likely to be very effective.
Well, it isn't in other states. It's only here in California so far where they're regulating assault-style weapons, which I tend to disagree with. You know how things go. You need to be at least equally yoked when you're in a... You know, you can't bring a knife to a gunfight, per se.
Yeah, that's right. Although there are not a lot of incidents where assault weapons are used for personal self-defense. There might be a question about whether they're necessary for people to have to defend against the government. But I guess when I think of the idea of the armed citizenry as being a deterrence against tyrannical government, it's not so much that we would have the weaponry that we could just take up arms and fight against the U.S. Army. That would never be an effective strategy. We'll never have the firepower able to do that. The idea is really that we would have so many arms among the population that the government would not turn to tyranny, would not send troops out to take away our liberties, because troops would know they would get fired upon. And while obviously the military at the end of the day is going to win, they've got the overwhelming firepower. We cannot match them. The idea is having enough firepower that they would be dissuaded from ever doing it. And I think with 320 million firearms in America, if that's the argument, I think that's probably satisfied. And I don't think we have that much to worry about personally.
Well, there seems to have been a lot of ploys that have been put in place for gun grabs. I was reading on Veterans Today that parts of the administration actually said that Sandy Hook was somewhat of a hoax to try to pull the guns out of people. And they did pass laws in the state of Massachusetts to try to have people come in and register their weapons.
Well, I don't know about what you heard, so I can't comment on that particular story. I haven't seen it. I will say this about in January, about a month after the Newtown shootings, I went to Newtown myself. I did an event there with where I had the chance to meet many of the family members who had their children, who lost children that day. And one thing I can tell you for 100% certainty, you couldn't sit in that room without feeling the pain of one couple after another who had lost their kids. They were crying uncontrollably. That was no hoax that went on there. And having met those people, I just can't tolerate that idea. Maybe if someone wants to say it's a conspiracy, I'd like to see the evidence to show that. But if it was an effort to try to promote gun control, it was a totally failed effort to promote gun control. Yeah, they got some new laws passed in Connecticut and New York, places that already had pretty serious gun control. But I think for the Democratic Party, the association with gun control has been an electoral loser. So the idea that the Democrats would push this so that they can regulate guns only to then cost them in the next election would be a short-sighted strategy But maybe that's exactly what we might expect from Washington politics these days anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they're doing anything for the people anymore. It seems like they're only working with the corporations, and that's not the way it's supposed to be. You're a constitutional lawyer. What do you think about that, to where they're no longer working for the people and all the donations are coming in from big corporations? The bankers are taking advantage of the people, and so forth. That is not a part of the republic that was pretty much founded for us.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the major changes in American politics that sort of shows maybe some of one of the difficulties of relying on our framers for all of our wisdom is that one thing they didn't imagine was the modern corporation. You know, the corporations were very rare in the founding era. They were used for government entities like municipal corporations. Cities were often corporations or churches. And only a handful of business corporations even in existence at the time of the framers. So they didn't think about how these might affect our constitutional rights. And what we've seen is the rise of the large corporation, which both affects our rights as individuals, interferes with those rights, but also has been able to gain the constitutional rights that were originally intended for ordinary people. Continually having the Supreme Court saying that corporations are protected by the Constitution. So we've really seen them take over in some ways our Constitution.
Yeah, it's definitely been hijacked. What can we do as a people to turn this around in a peaceful manner, in a peaceful situation? Because everybody's up in arms. We know that the nation is in economical despair, and the rights are being violated on daily basis. Police, in some instances, are killing people and getting away with it. How can we take back our republic and make it work for the people again?
Well, I think you ask an important question, and one, frankly, that Americans have asked really since the founding era. You know, a student of history always sees in almost every other generation a real sense that America has gotten off its tracks and it needs to be redeemed. And that's an important element of American society, that idea that we are always trying to make ourselves a more perfect union. I think the way you do it is through political mobilization. Look, it's not going to be, frankly, the next revolution is not going to be people taking up arms against the U.S. government. I don't think anyone realistically wants to see the great experiment in American democracy, one of the greatest, most important achievements in human history, the idea that we can have this 200-year-plus democracy with peaceful civilian transitions. There's no reason why anyone should hope to see that us lose that that great tradition, which is, frankly, if we want to think about what is the great American exceptionalism in world history, it is that contribution to world history. So we should never give that up in an armed revolution unless we absolutely have to. I think the better answer is through political mobilization. I think people are seeing that their rights are at stake and being infringed, and they are getting angry, and we need to figure out the right way and the right solutions to some of these problems. But the answer is going to be through the political process and through the experiment of American democracy, of free speech, free elections, equal rights. That's what's gotten us here so far, and I think it's what's going to make our more perfect union in the future.
As a constitutional attorney, do you have any plans yourself on how to battle it and what you might, as a citizen, do?
Well, one of the big things that people are talking about these days is a constitutional amendment. Do we need a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United? That's the case that we were referring to earlier, right, that says that corporations and unions can give unlimited amounts of money to support electoral candidates, something that has been said to be responsible for a lot more money in the electoral process and was at least indirectly responsible for the super PACs that we saw that enabled people like Sheldon Adelson to give something like $90 million in the last presidential election. So they're talking about constitutional amendment. It'd be interesting to see what what that looks like. One possibility that's gotten a lot of press is the idea of a constitutional amendment to take away corporate personhood, to say that corporations are not people under the Constitution. I think that particular amendment is the wrong solution to the problem, in part because there's other corporations like news organizations that really need to have constitutional rights so that they're not censored by the government. There's a long history of government censorship. And if corporations don't have rights, it means that the mom and pop shop down the block that is formed as a corporation wouldn't have basic protections of due process, couldn't protect its documents from having the government come in and seize them on a fishing expedition. So we don't want to say corporations shouldn't have any constitutional rights. So I think that would be one way of trying to approach the problem that would probably be misguided.
Oh, that might work, but we will discuss it when we come back. We'll be right back with our guest, Adam Winkler. And check out his book. It's called Gunfight. Gunfight. We'll be right back on the BBS Radio Network. This is Rakesh.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive, but there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBS
Radio.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world for the program.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Welcome back to The People Speak. This is Rakesh with the author of The Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, Adam Winkler. Adam, welcome back on our second half of the program. I've got questions for you from our audience. We have Mike in California wants to know if Professor Winkler agrees with Thomas Jefferson and the right to bear arms was for the people to defend themselves against a tyrannistical government. even a tyrannical government was their own.
Yeah, you know, there's no doubt that our founding fathers were armed revolutionaries, right? We should never lose sight of that fact. They took up arms to fight a revolution against a tyrannical government. They considered themselves British, right? They were Englishmen. They were just here, and they were thought they were mistreated politically, and rose up against that mistreatment and took up arms to fight for their liberty. So they definitely believed in the right of revolution. But I think the founding fathers thought that the Constitution was going to solve those problems. And if you look back in the history of the Constitution, what you see is that the framers thought that the Constitution was designed to endure for ages to come, and that this would be a structure that would create a government that would be limited, that would not turn tyrannical because of the Constitution itself. And they viewed the Second Amendment in complicated terms as both a way of sort of providing that overall self-defense deterrent against government takeovers. But also remember, at the time, they didn't have a police force. They didn't have a standing army. That Second Amendment was also by making sure that we would have a military fighting force that would defend ourselves at a time of sort of very insecure national security, right? We were a young nation that could have been taken over by the French. You know, who knew who's coming to war next? Hostile natal tribes. The Spanish, right? I mean, there were enemies out there, we needed that well-regulated militia to protect ourselves against other nations as well. So the right to bear arms was it wasn't the libertarian idea many people have today. It was much more complicated and much more situated to their times, which is that they needed those we the people to come and fight the wars in an era where there were no standing armies.
That would be correct, but also... You know, in my military oath, we had this part in the oath where it says we will defend the Constitution from enemies foreign and domestic. And that wasn't just for the military. That was, that was also not just for invading forces, but it was also for the tyrannistical government that is trying to take away the Constitution of the Republic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that part of the idea of the armed civilianry, the armed militia, we the people, with our own firearms, part of that idea was that it would protect against tyrannical government, and that if called to serve, we would rise up as necessary. But I think that's I wouldn't take that to mean that we should, like I say, forsake our Constitution and the great experiment in American democracy. That really is what we should be trying to preserve rather than overturn.
I agree. What I wanted to go into on that basis, can you see that our government is actually heading in that direction to where it's no longer, once again, working for the people of the Republic, and it's working for the corporations, for outside entities, outside nations? How can we stop that? I mean, you know, I'm not racist, I'm not against anything, but I see money, our money, being wasted in other nations while people in this nation are starving.
No doubt. I think there's good cause to be concerned about the role of money in politics. I don't think it's a problem that we can ever eliminate. You know, if you look back at American history, you don't see any time when power and money weren't really influential in Washington and in state houses. Power runs with money, always has, and frankly, to a certain extent, always will. But I think we can shape the system in a way that works for us rather than just for the business interests. Unfortunately, we're not getting a lot of protection from many of the institutions that usually we can count on to protect ourselves. The Supreme Court today is really much more interested in protecting the rights of big business than it is ordinary individuals in many cases. There's been studies that show that the most successful advocate before the Supreme Court today is the Chamber of Commerce. So in a lot of ways, we can't depend on the Supreme Court to protect us from business. Many in Washington are captured by business interests and plan to go lobby for those very business interests. There's no doubt that reform needs to be undertaken. But again, there's never been a period in American history where Americans haven't said, our government is too corrupt, our government is too responsive to the wealthy and the powerful, and that we need to restore democracy for we the people. So even our frustration is in some sense part of the American tradition.
Right. Sarah in Kansas wants to know, Adam, do you think that stricter gun control laws will ever happen, considering the gun lobbyists control Congress? I don't see it ever happening.
You know, I will say there's a short-term answer to the question and a long-term answer to the question. So I think in the short term, I understand and agree with the frustration of your listener. It does not seem like anything's going to happen, at least at the federal level, I think, in the near future. You are seeing some activity at the state level. We've seen gun control laws since Newtown adopted in major states like Connecticut, New York, California, Maryland, Colorado. These are big states with important populations. So you've seen some improvement in gun control laws, although frankly, you've seen some laws that have gone the other way, laws that have made guns more easy to get. And in fact, by one count, by the New York Times, it seems that more states have adopted laws making guns more easy to access and carry around than laws that have been restrictive since the Newtown. I think what we're seeing, though, is interesting. We're seeing a political mobilization by the gun control movement, which we haven't seen before. You know, the NRA has been a very effective political fighting force, and one of the most effective in Washington for a long time. And it's in part because they mobilize voters. They mobilize people that turn out in a tight election, people who are single-issue pro-gun voters, and they'll cast their ballot for the one that the NRA tells them to. And you haven't had that on the gun control side. And you're seeing Michael Bloomberg now with his new organization, Everytown USA. You're seeing the Gabrielle Giffords Super PAC that's been started. There's more of an effort to mobilize on the gun control community. If that movement is successful, it will identify more gun control voters who support things like background checks. But if not, then I would expect to see the NRA continue to win those political fights.
Well, I don't like Michael Bloomberg too much. It seems like his heart is for a foreign nation more than it is for the people and the citizenry of New York or the United States.
Well, he certainly doesn't like those people who drink those big sodas, right?
Yeah, that too. But I mean, I'm in agreement with him there. But it seems like his dedication is more towards Israel than than it is for here in the United States.
Huh. Well, I certainly know that I have a lot of friends that wish he were still the mayor of New York City because they like him over the one that's currently there. It's not. I don't have any personal stake in that question. But at least some New Yorkers thought he was okay. But I think what's most interesting, whether you like Bloomberg or not, is how it has the potential to change the gun debate. If that works, I think you will see more gun control laws. And also in answer to your listener's question, there's the long-term answer. I think that you might see more gun control laws in the future. I think that, you know, part of the reason why the NRA has been as strong as it has been is because many people in the gun-owning community believe that the government really is out there to try to get our guns. The Supreme Court has recently said you have a right to have those guns. The government can never come take those rights or those guns and those rights away. If that Supreme Court decision becomes a more settled, permanent part of our constitutional fabric, it becomes a right that we take for granted, the way we take for granted so many of our other important constitutional rights, then I think you'll see an era where you might pass more laws protecting against sort of requiring things like background checks because people won't be concerned that they're really going to lose their right to bear arms because they'll know they can count on the courts to protect them.
I've got a question from Phil. It's actually a follow-up because I already asked you the question about Sandy Hook. He wants to know if you looked into whether governments have orchestrated events in the past to push populations towards tighter gun controls?
You know, there have been rumors of government manipulation of all sorts of events. There were some in the sort of extreme of the gun rights community who in the 1960s claimed that the government had orchestrated the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King as a way to promote gun control laws. It doesn't seem likely to me, in part because none of the gun control laws that they're really proposing to be adopted significantly restrict the number of guns in circulation or make it more likely that government tyranny will result. You know, even if you ban the sale of assault weapons, there's still millions of them already out there. They weren't banning the possession of them. They were going to ban the sale of them. If you ban the sale of high-capacity magazines, there's still tens and tens, maybe 100 million of those high-capacity magazines in circulation already. Who knows what the exact number is, but a lot of them are already out there. If you have background checks on gun purchases, it doesn't stop the law-abiding person like you or me from getting their hands on firearms. It just doesn't. We've had background checks on the majority of gun purchases for 20 years, and what we've seen is the stockpile of firearms has skyrocketed during that time. So it hasn't restricted civilian ownership of firearms. So I think in light of those things, it's almost, why would you stage such a big incident so that you can get these minor, relatively ineffective gun control laws adopted? It just doesn't make sense to me as a great conspiracy. I can see more benefit if you were trying to start a war in Iraq and have justification for it. I could see throwing some planes into the Twin Towers would make more sense. There's at least something to gain from having huge defense spending that's going to benefit some administration. So, I mean, that was a story I didn't really believe myself, but at least it made sense. Like, there was a motive that made sense. This one, I just don't see the motive. It just doesn't ring true to me.
Oh, you're talking about 9/11 being a motive to go to war?
Right. I mean, that's a story. Well, there was really something to gain from this staged incident. I think banning assault weapons and having background checks really wasn't that much to gain for the Democrats. And in fact, I think what they found is what every Democratic pollster who advised the Obama administration before Newtown would have said, which was that this is an electoral loser. Don't support gun control because it's going to cost you. You're not going to get it passed, and it's going to cost you. It's exactly what's happened. Obama knew that. That's why he didn't talk about gun control for the first term, right? Didn't want to talk about it in the re-election campaign because he knows it's a loser. And if there weren't for Newtown, he wouldn't be talking about it today. If it was a grand conspiracy, it's like most of those grand conspiracies, pretty failed in its effort because it hasn't worked.
I've got a little recording. I'm trying to see if we can play it here real quick, but maybe I'll just go over it myself. It's Obama, I believe it was at a G8 summit, where he was talking about the ordinary person being simple-minded and that the ordinary person should just surrender their rights to a higher power of sovereignty. Does that sound tyrannistical to you, or?
Well, I certainly don't like the sounds of that sentence, that's for sure.
Exactly. I don't like the sounds of it either. And
I also don't like the sounds of justifications that the administration can kill American citizens with drones without due process. Certainly don't like the kind of spying we're seeing on our telephone lines. I think there's no doubt that there's some... The government, especially with regards to the war on terror, has become far too intrusive on our constitutional rights.
Right, and I'm in full agreement on that. Let's see what other questions we have here for you. Okay, we've got Jenna in Oregon. After horrible gun massacres in Australia and the UK, government stepped in to enforce strict gun control. Well. I might add to that a little bit. There are people in the UK and Australia that are against the gun control because they're seeing that they're not able to defend themselves against these people. What's your idea on that, Adam?
Well, there is a history of people, of governments using gun control as a first step to try to oppress people. And in fact, while we often talk about examples in other countries, like Germany, for instance, there's been some good recent books that have been published about, for instance, Steve Holbrook's book about how gun control led to the Nazis in some ways. And while I think that that story can be exaggerated in some ways, depending on how one portrays it, certainly gun control was part of the way in which people were oppressed. And we don't have to go that far from home to see that. It was part of the story of guns in America. You know, the KKK began, in, at least in some sense, by one view, at least, as a gun control organization. Before the Civil War, blacks in the South were never allowed to own guns, but during the war, many blacks began to arm themselves for self-protection. And the KKK formed after the Civil War as a way for whites to reestablish white supremacy. And a key part of the strategy for reestablishing white supremacy was making sure that those blacks did not have guns so that they could not fight back and that they could not emerge victorious. And that they could be effectively enslaved or oppressed once again. And indeed, in the 1960s, many people said that the gun control laws became so prevalent in that era was largely because of how racialized they were, and that they were in part a way to make it harder for African Americans to get their hands on guns. If so, they weren't that effective at doing it.
Jill in Missouri wants to know, Professor Winkler, do you own a gun? And if you did, would you use it in self-defense? And if you don't own a gun, how would you deal with defending yourself and your family?
Well, certainly, I'm a big subscriber to the school that, you know, you don't put a big sign up in front of your house saying, I have guns or don't have guns. I am a shooter. I do enjoy firearms and have done quite a bit of shooting with a lot of different firearms. And so I consider myself a gun enthusiast. But my self-defense in my home, try to get in. I guess you'll find out.
Exactly. Jack, is it Jack or Jock in Scotland Yard? He's saying with 45% of Americans suffering from some form of mental illness in their lifetime, would prohibiting guns ownership for the people with mental illness produce a stigma which may deter them from seeking help, resulting in dangerous psychotic behavior going?
Yeah, you know, it's very possible that that will be the case. I could imagine some people. Imagine if you were someone who really had a love of firearms. You were a real gun enthusiast. Maybe even serve in the military. Maybe you're worried that you've got maybe some post-traumatic stress issues, but you love your firearms and you know that if you go and get counseling, that they're going to take away your firearm. You might not go get that counseling. Now, on the other hand, I think there's probably a lot of people who might be identified as being dangerous if their counselors could reveal that they've been made a threat. But I don't think that we're seeing any real move towards laws that are going to target all of those 45 million people who have some form of mental illness. Indeed, under the current rules, you're only denied access to a firearm if you've been adjudicated to be mentally ill under federal law. California law is slightly broader, but not very much. That adjudication has to happen by a court or similar kind of board, it really undercounts the number of people who are dangerously mentally ill, probably, rather than overcounts. So,
okay. Andy in New Jersey wants to know, have you looked into the claims that 9/11 was an act of false flag terrorism, along with subsequent anthrax attacks? What do you think of those claims?
Yeah, I've never investigated them personally. I've always had always wondered about them, but I really don't have enough knowledge about those to speculate much about it. You know, my book is on guns and on the history of guns and gun control in America, and I do know that there were those who, after 9/11, thought that one of the reasons why 9/11 happened was because we didn't allow people to have guns on airplanes, and that some people have argued since then that we should be able to have guns on airplanes, and that would make it less likely that we would have an incident like 9/11, because people could rise up and fight against their terrorist who tries to take them over. I don't think that's we're about to see laws that allow guns on airplanes, but nonetheless, it shows perhaps the way in which the battle over the right to bear arms gets manifested in all of disputes, even ones like 9/11. They might not really think were really about guns.
Well, that is very true. We've seen in some cases where people, you know, have been able to defend themselves against mass murder attacks, like in the McDonald's in Texas, where a man was able to draw out his weapon and shoot the guy that was already killing people, which I believe wholeheartedly that it, you know, more citizenry out there that are able to defend themselves, you're less likely to be victimized. You can only be victimized if you're willing to be a victim. And it seems like a lot of people don't understand that, and they will never understand it unless they are victimized in that sort of fashion.
Well, and that is really one of the most important and heated debates in gun policy today, which is, are we safer on the streets today if more people are carrying concealed weapons, or if we have fewer people carrying concealed weapons? Right, there's the in favor of the idea that more guns equals less crime is the idea that in states that have allowed people to carry guns more permissively over the last 30 years, there's been a huge wave of laws making it easier for most people in most states to carry guns, that they've seen reductions in violence in those places. There's others who disagree with that data and it's been subject to some scrutiny. One thing we have seen from the data that there is that's pretty clear is whether or not it leads to reductions in violence. We haven't seen spikes in violence in places where they've allowed more people, law-abiding people, to carry guns in public. So many in the gun control community swear that, oh, we're going to see huge rises, spikes in crime as people turn to firearms to solve ordinary disputes. And while that occasionally does happen, firearms will occasionally be taken out to suffer ordinary disputes, it doesn't have a statistically significant impact, at least in terms of rising criminal violence.
I've seen it to be on the contrary. I've seen it to be on the opposite end of the foot. I see crime in areas where people were carrying weapons to reduce because criminals think twice. See, when they know they can victimize, they will. But when they know that there's a chance that they might be fought off or possibly shot and killed, they tend to think about it twice instead of going out and victimizing. So the psychological theory of it is, does it stop people from wanting to commit the crimes? In my theory, yes. And I don't know what your take is on it, but
I think it makes sense. I mean, and maybe that's why there is some data to suggest there is some reduction in crime. Like I say, that data is subject to dispute, and there's been contrary studies on both sides that some show there is some reduction, some show there is no reduction whatsoever. It depends on the variables that you look at. So it's a little bit in dispute. Part of the issue is, though, is that even if you allow people to carry guns, there's still only a small percentage of people who carry guns. So maybe it doesn't have the disincentive effect maximized as it would if more people were carrying guns. Usually it's only about 5% of people who get concealed carry permits, even in states that are very permissive about carrying firearms. And of those percentages, it's not clear how many carry their guns on a regular basis, but it's probably not more than 1 or 2% of the total population who carry guns on a regular basis. So as long as the numbers are that small, probably doesn't have the hugest impact on criminals who presumably are going to use the element of surprise in their own firearms to stop you from doing anything. But there's certainly some logic to the idea that they're not going to come attack you if they think you're going to fight back.
Oh, absolutely. You know, here's the fallacy of it all. These gun control activists want to take away your rights to have a gun in your possession, but they want you to call a man with a gun to come and help you. I'd never understood that theory, and I've never understood that fallacy. Police cannot protect you. They can only come and investigate the crime and maybe, if you're lucky, bring some justice to the fact. But other than that, you have to defend yourself, and you have to be able to defend yourself. against anybody, whether it be it a criminal or even law enforcement that are out of their realm of authority and they are infringing on your rights. You should be able to defend yourself against any of this.
Well, and that's what the Supreme Court has said is at the core of the Second Amendment, that not only do you have a right to bear arms, but that the core of that right is a right to protect yourself against criminals who are going to hurt you, in addition to the idea of protecting against government tyranny. This is an important principle, and this idea of self-defense is one that the Supreme Court has now recognized. I think it's a very, very well, long-established right in American law, and it seems appropriate that now we have constitutional protections to make that happen and make that vibrant. One of the biggest questions will be whether you have that right of self-defense to carry guns in public. The Supreme Court has yet to answer the question about whether you have the Second Amendment protects your right to carry guns into public places, and if it does, what kind of licensing can the government impose on people who want to carry guns in public? And that's sort of one of the real questions. When's the Supreme Court going to answer that question? I think everyone in the gun community and in the gun control community sort of waited with bated breath to find out what's going to happen there. The Supreme Court had a couple cases presented to it this term where it could have answered that question. It chose not to answer them and leaves us hanging.
Right. This is such a great conversation. I really don't want to leave it, but I've got a minute left, and I wanted to add a bunch of different things to the show, but we'll have to have you on again, Adam. It's been a lot of fun. People go out and buy the book. It's called Gunfight by author Adam Winkler. My closing statement tonight will be this. Governments that want total domination over its people are tyrannies. We have seen what happens to other nations, like in Germany, when the people are disarmed. Nothing changes. Homicides, suicides, and crimes will still continue. Changing laws that only hinder your rights to own firearms and only work for those who want to take away your rights to the Second Amendment shall not be infringed is just that. All laws and prohibitions against the Second Amendment are passed against the will of the people, each and every single statehood and sovereignty. Only when governments or racist groups of people want to dominate the entire power of that nation. This is Rock Cash signing out on the BBS Radio Network. Don't forget to join us next week. Samantha Legend will have a show on yoga. Thank you very much for joining us on the BBS Radio Network. Good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.